This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm back, and I'm here for right now just with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
We're recording this episode in a strange way this week because I'm in New York City, which is very exciting for me. It's the first time back since the pandemic. And it meant I got to see West Side Story at the, not at the premiere where Steven Spielberg was, a couple blocks downtown, but still very exciting. Richard, you've seen it too. So we'll talk about West Side Story, the Gotham Awards and your top 10 list, which are out this week. And then very soon after, you'll hear from David and Rebecca, David Canfield and Rebecca Ford, who talked about Nightmare Alley, which as we record this, Richard, you and I are seeing it later. They have seen it. The embargo will lift. There's a lot of time shifting happening. But West Side Story and Nightmare Alley are kind of the two last big pieces of award season. So it's a particularly exciting week. Are you feeling the Oscar hype, Richard?
Oh, yeah. I mean, couldn't West Side Story be called Nightmare Alley in some senses?
Yeah, that alley where they're like swinging the paint cans at the sharks.
Right, exactly. West Side Story, you know, there's a funny, I won't spoil, but there's a funny irony about seeing that movie at Lincoln Center like we did, or in that general area to that movie. But it has a sense of occasion about it in a way that that I've been kind of missing for part of this season. And I hope that seeing Nightmare Alley with you tonight recreates that same sensation of something big and splashy and, I dare say, studio commercial kind of thing to supplement all of the smaller, artier stuff that I've been enjoying this fall so far.
Yeah, something's coming, something's good, you might even say.
Exactly.
Thank you for laughing. Before we get too deep into those, so I do want to say we've got two interviews at the end of the show as well. And kind of speaking of smaller and artier, honestly. So our colleague Chris Murphy talked to Halle Berry about her directorial debut Bruised, which will be on Netflix. And I talked to Gabby Hoffman, who is in Come On, Come On, which is kind of one of my favorite of the smaller movies that's been out this fall. So we're running the gamut here this week on Little Gold Men. But Richard, I think I want to save West Side Story for last. And let's talk about the Gotham Awards, which happened on Monday night as West Side Story was premiering in New York City. And you were there, which is why we didn't see West Side Story together. So how were the Gothams?
They were good. I mean, it was surreal to be, not that I go to many award shows themselves. I talk about them a lot, but I don't go to a lot of them. But it was kind of wonderful to be back in a room with lots of colleagues and people I'm a fan of. I sat at the table with Ryosuke Hamaguchi, who made Drive My Car, which is a great movie. He also made Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, which is also great this year. And he won, and we all got to stand, everyone at the table stood up and clapped. And it felt very
normal
and exciting in a way that, you know, we have been denied a lot of those kind of events for the last almost 2 years. You know, everyone was obviously vaccinated and we had to present a negative COVID test to get in. So it was, I hope, as safe as it could be. Mm-hmm. And it was also an exciting, interesting year at the Gothams because they had done away with gendered acting categories. There were a lot of tributes to like Peter Dinklage and Kristen Stewart and Jane Campion. The star wattage was high. And yeah, it was just a cool kind of thing to be able to do after so much time of doing nothing remotely like that.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up Jane Campion, who was there for a tribute, but it was a big night for Netflix beyond her film, because Maggie Gyllenhaal, like, didn't quite sweep, but kind of came close to sweeping. It was a really big night for The Lost Daughter.
Best picture, best screenplay, best director. I mean, it was really, yeah.
And best performer for Olivia Colman.
Yeah, yeah.
Or lead performance, I guess.
So they had done, you know, the non-gendered acting categories. There was, happens a tie for lead performance between Olivia Colman and Frankie Faison for The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain. But yeah, but I mean, The Lost Daughter was clearly the narrative of the evening. I felt like every time I would turn down to my dinner plate, take a sip of wine and look up, Maggie Gyllenhaal was back on stage, which, you know, was huge for that movie, which I don't know. I kind of think, I almost wonder if Netflix didn't quite know that it had this kind of awardsy juggernaut on its hands, even as far, you know, as recently as Telluride. I feel like they were kind of almost caught off guard by how well that film was received.
I feel like I remember talking about that from Telluride and then, you know, other festivals, that like the response was so effusive because it's a prickly movie. It's not like Belfast, like a big, you know, heartwarmer about family. Like it has very conflicted ideas about family, in fact. But I do think it's proving its staying power.
It could almost be the complete opposite of a heartwarmer about family in an interesting way. And I think that's what makes part of it so interesting to people, is that it is a narrative that we don't see on film a lot, which is about not just, oh, it's hard to raise kids, but like, it's really hard and I kind mm-hmm. of hate it. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, it has a kind of, if I were, I don't know, if I were in the Gyllenhaal Skarsgård family, if I was one of the kids, I might be like, huh. That was your first choice for directing a movie? Okay.
You know, women have to make choices, Richard and Hannah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we talked before, and worth emphasizing again, that the voting body of the Gothams has almost nothing to do with the Academy or SAG or anything. Like, yep. You get noteworthy people, but they're very small, which is why I think you get interesting winners like this. Although it is interesting that you get a sweep when you've got different people voting on each category and all of them gravitate toward the same movie. I do think that says something. Like, whether or not the Oscars will go for The Lost Daughter, I think, is a question, but there clearly is a huge amount of affection for it.
Yeah, the Gothams are interesting because it's a lot of critics and journalists who do the nominating. And mm-hmm. then the actual jury who votes on those nominations is, you know, a combination of filmmakers and actors and whatnot. So you get these kind of two filters of snobby critics and then more industry supportive people who work in the more directly in the industry. But I think that so Coda, Troy Kotsur mm-hmm. from Coda, and Emilia Jones both won acting awards. Jones won breakthrough performer, Kotsur won supporting performance. Those two wins and the makeup of the jury suggests to me that, like, if nothing else, Coda is going to do well at the SAGs.
Yes, the actors are responding to that movie.
Exactly, which could then translate into Oscars. And, you know, I think Coda has been a big question mark because it was this huge hit at Sundance almost a year ago. It was the biggest sale ever when Apple bought it. And then it came out in the late summer and sort of didn't quite match that Sundance response, but I think it's been slowly persisting, and it's one that's easy for people to watch if they have Apple TV Plus, or they can, you know, I'm sure myriad screeners have been sent out, but it seems to be lasting in a way that I'm sure Apple and everyone else is very happy with.
And it's also something you imagine at the, you're looking at your metaphorical screener pile now, you're like, oh, that one seems fun. Like, that one's, it's a pleasant watch as opposed to, you know, The Lost Daughter or plenty of other movies that are more of a challenge.
It has sad moments, but it is not depressing in the way that a lot of, you know, typical awards films are.
Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about supporting categories more in a little bit when we get to West Side Story, I think, but they are remarkably in flux, which is why I think Troy Kotsur's win was especially exciting. Like, you know, it feels too literal because Sound of Metal is also a movie about deafness, but like, if Paul Racy could get in, why can't Troy Kotsur get in?
Well, right. And Troy Kotsur is actually deaf, which had been some issue about Racy's nomination in that category since it happened.
Yeah, although Paul Racy was at Coda, which is a term I didn't know when he was nominated. And then anyway, it's a fascinating series of movies to teach us all something we didn't know. Any other highlights from the Gothams for you, Richard?
I was just kind of like awash in the whole experience because it was, again, so surreal to be doing anything remotely like that. But, you know, there were some really cool things, like Reservation Dogs won a big award, which people were really excited about. And the Frankie Faison win was cool. Ethan Hawke gave a lovely albeit long speech introducing Peter Dinklage's tribute award, which was cool. Julianne
Moore. He won an award, right? Didn't Ethan Hawke win a TV award?
He also won performance for a new series. He tied with Tuso Mbedu from Underground Railroad.
That's a good pair.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny with these non-gendered acting categories that there were so many ties, and it happened to be a man and a woman who won. But you know, I think that as a first foray into the genderless acting categories for a pretty big award show, I think it proved mostly successful.
Yeah. Well, I saw that one of the movies on your top 10 list won an award, which might be a decent transition into your top 10 list. Richard, I feel like you've been kind of struggling over it, which maybe is what happens every year. But was it especially hard to narrow it down this year for a top 10?
Yeah, because I would say like 20 films were number 11, you know, look, to pull the curtain back, this is all made up. I don't know. I could feel differently about this list tomorrow or did feel differently about it last week. But just in the moment that I had to actually write the thing, the 10 movies I chose were the ones that felt best representative of the year. A lot of depressing movies, but also hopefully some ones that left people feeling a little bit cheered about life in the world. But yeah, Drive My Car, which was my number two choice, was the table I was at the Gotham Awards. I was really happy to see that movie pick up a trophy, especially because, as I said, Hamaguchi had two movies out this year, both of which are really great.
Yeah, that's not a bad track record there.
Yeah, Ridley Scott's like, well, I mean, you know, so did
I. Was Lady Gaga in yours?
Yeah.
And Flea was on there too, which I was so happy to see because that was a Sundance movie that, you know, I haven't seen it since Sundance. I was with Mass, actually, which is also on your list. But I'm so glad it feels fresh for you. And I'm excited to revisit it, too.
Yeah, I was able to watch Flea with my parents over Thanksgiving. I had already seen it, obviously, but I wanted to do a refresh before I wrote my list just to make sure that I wasn't wrong all the way back in January. And, you know, they loved it. And I think it's the kind of movie that when you say documentary about people fleeing Afghanistan as the Taliban comes to power in the late 80s, that sounds, again, depressing and sort of harrowing, but and it is certainly in the film, this story that this guy tells is quite something. But it's animated because partly they're obscuring the identity of the person being interviewed, but also because there's a lot that just wasn't filmed, that this guy is remembering these huge events from his childhood and they needed some way to render those. Mm-hmm. And I think the animation really works. But it has a really resonant humanity about it. It's there are funny parts and kind of not romantic exactly, but maybe hints at future romance or anything, you know, it has kind of the whole of life's experience in the film. It's not just a sort of look at this geopolitical catastrophe.
Yeah. I mean, some of the standout segments for me that I remember from all the way back in January is like two guys looking for a house with like a cat outside and like a very cute cat, or like a big pivotal emotional scene happens outside like a club, you know, it's very, human and lived in, like you were saying.
And my second viewing confirmed my basest reaction to the film, which is that I have a crush on both of the cartoon guys.
I mean, that's another essence of the human experience that I think
exactly.
is. I mean, people will be able to see your list. You mentioned that Worst Person in the World would be on it when we talked about it a few weeks ago. It's in fact at number one, which I don't think surprised me. I think you were pretty settled on that one for a while, right?
Yes. I mean, I did, again, rewatch it a couple weeks ago at a screening in New York, and that really confirmed it for me. I think that, look, could Drive My Car be number one instead of number two? Sure. But Worst Person in the World for me is so seamlessly made while taking a lot of risks stylistically and whatnot. It again contains so much of life. I think it's hard to categorize what that film is. And I think that the thing that I've been and other people have been going to is like romantic comedy. And it kind of is that. But there's so much more, especially as the film kind of draws toward the end, where the director Joachim Trier is kind of saying, well, this is really about a lot more than just romantic entanglements and feeling unsteady about, you know, your love life in your 30s. I think he really is asking the audience to take stock of more of life and the time and how we spend it. And I, you know, for those reasons, I think it's a sad movie, but it also made me feel happy at the very end. And that counts for a lot these days.
Yeah, I was trying to sell someone on it recently. I was like, okay, I know it's like a foreign language film that everyone loved at Cannes, but like, it's so accessible. It's such a movie that like hits you. And Bergman Island, which is at your number 10, like, I feel like they're a really interesting pair of, Scandinavian movies that, feel like they might be inaccessible. And Bergman Island's in English, but you know what I mean? Where like, yeah. mm-hmm. like, oh, this is an art house thing, but it's really, it's for everybody.
If the worst person in the world was in English, it would be the biggest thing at Sundance, you know, like, mm-hmm, it, like mm-hmm. it is a very entertaining, accessible movie, but that doesn't take away from its artistry at all. I think it kind of has the whole package, and Renata Reinspa, who is the lead, is just so extraordinary. And I hope that she, you know, has a good fortunes ahead of her for critics prizes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's just a really the movie glows, in a way that, made me feel like I had to put it at number one.
Yeah, speaking of critics prizes, this week you're going into the New York Film Critics Circle vote, so we'll get to talk about that next week. And the National Board of Review will announce their winners this week after we're recording. So the, you know, all this speculation is starting to lead to some hard votes. Are you feeling anxious about having to actually pick a favorite?
Well, being at the Gothams and talking to some colleagues who are also in the Critics Circle mm-hmm. with me helped clarify things. You know, I'm not saying on the record that we have any sort of block voting scheme going on for certain categories.
You're whipping votes in the cloakroom.
I mean, kind of, you know, felt very House of Cards. But, you know, I have some sense of where I'm going to go, at least for the first vote. The thing about the way that the New York Film Critics Circle vote works is that really the first vote is the one where you kind of throw out your Hail Marys mm-hmm. and then you see who actually got votes. And then you kind of have to be more strategic among like what actually could win. You know, if you're a little passion project pet thing, you were the only vote it got out of, you know, 40 something people, then you probably have to abandon that for round two.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, again, like the way that voting bodies work. Yeah. I think as we go through talking about all these different award winners, we really have to emphasize like the way the New York Film Critics Circle works is different from the Gothams, it's different from the SAGs. Like, and I think it's more interesting. I think it gets us a wider variety of things to honor.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think that is one of the potential joys of being able to do this, is that like here and there, a film that won't get recognized elsewhere will get, you know, some accolades from us.
Yeah. Well, a last question on your top 10. After seeing West Side Story, was there a moment where you were like, oh shit, I got to throw the whole thing out and put West Side Story on there?
There was a moment while watching it where I was like, oh, God darn it. but no, I think ultimately, I think it's a really good movie, but I had enough minor quibbles with it that I felt secure in it not having to be an emergency add-on to the list.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the fact that you consider that at all speaks a lot to the strength of it, because I'm pretty sure on the air, we have been sharing some skepticism about what it means to remake a pretty much perfect movie that won Best Picture, and what has been so fun for me, like both seeing it in person and then watching people react to it on Twitter, is just like all of my fellow skeptics I was with them being like, oh man, they did it. Like they really remade West Side Story and made it good. Like I'm still kind of astonished by it.
I think the most impressive thing about it at the outset is, Spielberg actually made the, and Tony Kushner actually made the case for why this remake exists. You know, uh-huh. like it didn't just feel like this kind of like, well, we're just kind of going through the motions, and Spielberg has always wanted to make a musical, and so now he gets to do it in his 70s. There is a real sense of purpose behind the movie, which that can't be easy given that the original film is so beloved and, you know, kind of revered as this classic of the form.
Yeah. And it's a sense of purpose that I think comes from the script that Tony Kushner did. And I think if you were like wondering, like, what's Tony Kushner going to give to a story that's so well established, there are just all of these small changes that add, I think, a lot of depth, both thematic and character wise, to what the story is. And then the musical numbers, like Spielberg's directing these musical numbers in new ways. Like it's songs that, you know, that you haven't seen that way before. They're moved around in the story. They have different meaning. There's so much careful attention to what you can do with this template to tell something, not a different story, but a new story, I think.
Yeah. What I think they get in very delicate balance is they keep some of the antiquated mother loving and when the spit hits the fan, you know, they keep those in the lyrics that Stephen's
sperm
deletes.
To worm. We were yeah, all very right. happy oh, to
yeah.
hear.
Yeah. But they also, they do dirty it up, and they contemporize it, you know, to sort of better match like what we're able to do on film now here and there. It feels a little more dangerous, a little sexier, a little bit, tiny bit more transgressive. It immensely helps that it's not people pretending to be Latinx. They're actually people from that culture who are playing these characters. But it's not looking back at the original film and saying, we're going to do this right this time. It's kind of honoring that, especially in the form of Rita Moreno, who's in both films and won an Oscar for the original. It's in dialogue with the stage musical, the movie from so many years ago, in a way that feels respectful, but also like, okay, now we're going to take a chance with it, which is exactly what the best revivals of on stage do. Mm-hmm. You know, a revival is not saying we're correcting past mistakes. It's kind of honoring it and trying to put their own stamp on it, which is exactly what Spielberg, who I think kind of sheds vanity in this. You know, he's not trying to prove that he's like, you know, I can do everything between Schindler's List and Jurassic Park and now musicals. I think he genuinely likes this piece of work and wanted to kind of take a crack at it.
Yeah. I mean, it feels contemporary. And I worry about saying that and people being terrified that they're going to, you know, be like wearing modern clothes. But the way that it is in dialogue with like our current conversations about like white men is so fascinating to me. And like, maybe this is something we should save until, you know, more people have seen it. But like the way that it links the Jets to the like angry young white men that we have today in a really like careful and not heavy-handed way. And it made me just kind of think of this conflict between the Jets and the Sharks in a different way, which I did not think was possible. Like, I thought I knew that story so well.
And it shows a certain coziness between those guys and the police.
Yes.
You know, where the police are, you know, get out of here, you knuckleheads. Like they're still doing their job to some extent when it comes to the Jets, but they're also giving them a lot more passes than they do to their Puerto Rican counterparts.
Yeah, I think it kind of solves the cop problem, but also Brian D'Arcy James as Officer Krupke is hilarious. And you can have both in a story. And you can have like Riff being this incredibly sympathetic, tragic figure. Mike Face is my favorite performance in the movie. And he's one of the Jets, and he's like one of the most racist of the Jets. And yet he emerges as a character that you empathize with. It's tricky stuff, and they do it well over and over again.
I think we have to praise Mike Face for two things. One is that he's great in West Side Story. Mm-hmm. Two is that my sources tell me was offered to reprise his Tony-nominated role in Dear Evan Hansen for the film and chose not to.
Interesting.
And he made a wise choice.
Interesting. Yeah, it did make me want to look up videos of that, having seen the movie. Okay, so we wanna move on so we can hear David and Rebecca talk about Nightmare Alley. But with David and Rebecca, after we had all seen West Side Story, I think while you were in it, Richard, we kind of wrote our piece that's up on VF.com about our pretty high enthusiasm for it Oscar-wise. And do you agree? Do you think that we're just drinking the Kool-Aid, or is it really in the thick of it now?
Oh, it's in the thick of it, yeah. I think one thing that's going to help it beyond the, you know, individual merits of the film itself is that I think it'll do really well.
I hope so, yeah.
It'll play well over Christmas. I think young fans who or new fans who aren't that familiar with the older versions of this story will kind of embrace it as their own, their generation's, you know, kind of version of this Romeo and Juliet tale. I think it has multi-quadrant appeal. And so, yeah, if it's able to kind of be one of the go-to hits of over the holiday season, that will help it a lot. I don't know. I feel, based just on the post, which did very well nominations wise, I kind of feel like the Academy has a weird relationship with Spielberg and has for a long time, because he's already, you know, he's won Best Director twice. He's won Best Picture. You know, he is obviously regarded as the American filmmaker of perhaps all time by certain metrics. So I think there maybe is a little bit of a reticence to return to that well in terms of actually handing him awards.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this movie has legs in all different sort of categories between, you know, from all the way up to Best Picture and then down into technicals and with some acting in between.
Yeah, the thing that I've gotten the most kind of enthusiastic about is Tony Kushner, who was nominated for Lincoln, which I love Lincoln very deeply, and didn't win. And I think his adaptation work on this is so remarkable, and you can see it. Like, I think everyone knows West Side Story enough to be able to see the work that he did on this. So maybe if they're feeling weird about Spielberg, Tony Kushner is the one to heap some attention on.
Yeah, I mean, that adapted is a really crowded category when you have, you know, consider Campions in there and other people. But yeah, I mean, Kushner, I take a little bit of issue with some of the changes that were made just in terms of who sings what and when. But that's really only two examples in the movie toward the end. But yeah, otherwise, it's again, like Spielberg, like Kushner is not trying to kill his darlings. He's not trying to be an iconoclast. He's just gently kind of massaging the text into something that it works a little bit better in the here and now.
Yeah. As you were saying earlier about it being a hit, like I saw this movie with my friends who I'm staying with, our previous and future guest, Chris Rosen, and his wife, Case Wickman. And we just got to drive home afterward and like yell about the movie and like get really excited about it. And I hadn't had that feeling in so long. And I really want people to have that feeling of just like going out of a movie, like vibrating and excited to talk about it.
Yeah. And I you know, there was a stretch early in the film where I just found myself forgetting that it was 10 a.m. and I had to write something afterward. And I really like the world, as corny as it sounds, did kind of fall away. Mm-hmm. Very much like Maria seeing Tony across the gym. You know, I went behind the bleachers with myself. Yes. And just was like, I love this movie. it really has, that kind of great old timey cinematic verve, and it's transporting in a way that, you know, I love smaller, more inaccessible, more alienating things. But once in a while, it is really great to see something that is kind of big and populist and works as much as it does in West Side Story's case.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we'll get to talk about it more next week. I'm very interested to see how it figures into the National Board of Review Awards. Like, I'm not expecting the New York or LA critics to like leap all over it, although you never know. But I think figuring out just how huge this is going to be an interesting puzzle for us over the next few weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are some old softies and young softies in the New York Film Critics Circle that could really embrace this movie and will be voting pretty much on the land where the things takes place, you know,
yeah,
in Lincoln Center.
Yeah. I feel like we fall in the middle ground of the middle softies, maybe. I don't know how young we get to be, but we're right in there.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read The Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Well, now let's throw to David and Rebecca and hear about the other giant movie that is finally making its debut this week. Let's hear them talk about Nightmare Alley.
Well, Rebecca, you and I have seen Nightmare Alley. I think we both liked it quite a bit. Unlike West Side Story, this movie came in, I think everyone had pretty high expectations. Guillermo del Toro's last film, The Shape of Water, won Best Picture, Director, and some craft categories. This film is one he'd been wanting to make for a long time. It's got an incredible cast, and I think it delivers on what we were hoping for, right?
Yeah, I think it at least met our pretty high expectations, if not exceeding them in some respect. I would say the performances are really, really enjoyable to watch. I thought Cate Blanchett was especially really strong and has some really interesting moments to sort of play with. So, you know, I could see her potentially in the supporting category. But, you know, in general, the cast is just such a strong A-list lineup. Obviously, Bradley Cooper is the lead. And you're sort of, I guess we should kind of summarize what it's about. you know, you're kind of following his character as he joins like a circus group and, you know, where it kind of, I don't want to reveal much more than that. You know, he interacts with a psychiatrist who's played by Blanchett, and as he sort of tries to climb his way up in his profession he's pursuing. It's really beautifully done, as I wouldn't expect anything less from Guillermo when he's playing in this kind of world. And to me, I think it plays really well. And I'm curious to see how it plays once other people see it. What did you think, David?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a pretty strong across the board contender. It feels like with all of these late breaking movies, we're getting these bigger overall players that have a lot of craft potential, have a lot of potential acting nominations that could go their way, that come from filmmakers with more of a proven Academy track record. And they're changing the shape of the race, it seems like, every day this week. And this one, I think, is definitely continuing in what West Side Story started earlier this week. You know, I was a little surprised by it at times, because Guillermo del Toro is known for horror movies and monster movies, including in a way The Shape of Water, which won Best Picture, which would not, you know, on paper sound Academy friendly. This one almost feels like it would be more awardsy. It's really a noir, very faithfully working off of the original novel, and it in some ways resembles the 40s film that was adapted from it, but also very much its own thing. And it has what I think is a really propulsive narrative. It's, without giving too much away, it's kind of two films in one that tie together at the end in a really satisfying way. And it moves really well. And I think that in a year where we've got, you know, trickier in art house movies like Power of the Dog and crowd pleasers, this one occupies a nice middle ground almost of like, a very artfully done, but very accessible movie. I'm curious what you think about its potential in the acting categories, because I agree that Bradley Cooper and Cate Blanchett are standouts. I also thought David Strathairn and Richard Jenkins were great among the supporting men, but both of them, their challenge is screen time. And Cate and Bradley, both of their performances kind of hinge on not revealing too much until really the last act of the film, or in one case, at least, you know, last scene of the film almost. Where do you see these various former Oscar nominees standing in terms of how far they can go?
I mean, if the best actor race weren't already so stacked and competitive, I would have said I feel like Bradley Cooper slides in there pretty easily. Because, you know, the more I think about this performance, it's just such an epic journey for that character. As you said, it's basically like two films. He, you know, starts out in one place and goes somewhere very, very different as it goes along. And that's a you know, heavy performance to carry on your back. And I think he does a really great job with it and has some really, really special moments in it, you know. But we're looking at a category that already has sort of as potential locks, you know, Will Smith, Benedict Cumberbatch, Andrew Garfield. And that means there's two spots that are maybe a little bit more up in the air. And, you know, Bradley is not known for pounding the pavement of award season, right? He doesn't do a ton of press. I think he's deserving, but we're talking about such, to me, the most competitive category of the year. So I think it's a wait and see for that one. And this, you know, the same with Cate. I think she's Cate Blanchett, right? She almost always delivers an amazing performance that sort of elevates any character she's taken on. And she also is in Don't Look Up this year. So she's got two things she's promoting. But to me, it seems like a wait and see what happens there as well in the supporting actress category. There's just a lot of films and a lot of performances. I think we've been saying it more than anything this year is like, yes, the movie's good, but look at these performances. You know, it's just each film seems to have at least one or two really standouts that is competing in a category that's already very, very full. But, you know, I think, you know, as you mentioned, Guillermo proved with Shape of Water that films that are a little different can make it in. And, you know, this film has a little gore and, you know, sort of that kind of thing that I shy away from. But I think he's so respected as a filmmaker. And I feel like this film could surprise us in different ways.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about Cate Blanchett because you and I saw it before we saw West Side Story. And I came out of that and I was like, oh, supporting actress, I feel like there are a few slots that really are unaccounted for. And I could easily see, if the movie does well, Kate taking one of those spots. And then we saw West Side Story, which feels like it could really conceivably field two nominees in supporting actress for Rita Moreno and Ariana DeBose. And it's, as these movies keep breaking, the path gets narrower. At least that's just our perspective, because, of course, these movies, by the time Academy voters are voting, all will be on a relatively even playing field. But it does feel like Kate might have a tough time breaking into that field, because supporting actress, to me, suddenly feels competitive. Supporting actor, I feel like, is still quite open. But I don't know that this film has a clear enough, someone with enough screen time, frankly, to be able to make it through.
Yeah.
Like, how far do you think this movie can go? I mean, I tend to think that it's a really strong effort from the guy who won Best Picture on his last movie, and that probably should not be underestimated, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're talking about Guillermo is lined up with most of the same team he works with, and it's also with Fox Searchlight, which is releasing the film, and released Shape of Water, and released Nomadland. Like, they obviously know what they're doing when it comes to awards, just, you know.
And this is their big contender.
Yeah, this is their big contender. I mean, obviously, they're under the Disney umbrella now, but, you know, they still sort of play in their own lane, and they know how to do this awards race, maybe better than anyone else. So, I don't know. Again, we need more people to see it and talk to more voters, but I don't think we can underestimate what this film could do. And similar to Shape of Water, right? It's going to be well respected and received by the crafts and those voters as well. I think it could get in, you know, production design, costume, score, things like that. And I think my general theory is, if those other departments really love a film, then its chances in Best Picture are much, much stronger. So I think we've got another strong contender here. These late bloomers are really messing up our predictions here, I think.
Yeah, I think part of it is, one interesting thing about this year is you have all these movies that were supposed to come out last year, now adding to this already pretty competitive 2021 pile, and Nightmare Alley being one of them, West Side Story another one. And it just feels like the season is getting a little overcrowded, which is quite good timing, since this is the first year that the Oscars Best Picture lineup is expanding to 10. And it feels pretty likely that both Nightmare Alley and West Side Story will be able to make their way through. I'm curious how much you knew about the story going in. I really didn't know much, and that was really helpful for me, just in terms of like kind of running with this narrative and not having any clue where it was going, and just being able to enjoy all these characters and actors popping up and the turns the story was taking, and seeing how Guillermo spun it. I guess as we are talking about it and trying not to reveal too much, what should people not maybe not expect going in, or avoid spoilers and things like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I went in pretty blind. I mean, I was aware it was an adaptation, but I didn't know much about the story. And I think that really made it enjoyable for me. I'm going to be curious how people, you know, who were fans of the book or at least aware of it, feel about it. But I think the surprising turns and just where the story goes made it so enjoyable, and it just felt really original. So yeah, I think I'm sure the filmmaker would love for us and everyone else who sees it early to not spoil it, because I do think it's just a really enjoyable journey. I feel like there's been a lot of that this season, you know. Don't say anything about this movie.
Yeah, I guess West Side Story is one where it can be pretty comfortably spoiled. Well, and even then, there are a few little surprises in there.
Yeah.
I did want to say that with this movie, I think there have been a lot of questions about why some of them have taken as long as they have. And this one, especially since it had been mostly shot pre-pandemic, not entirely, But I do want to shout out Nathan Johnson's score, and that was the reason why it was held, was that Alexander Desplat had to leave the film for scheduling reasons, and they had to bring in a last-minute new composer, Nathan Johnson, who is the brother of Ryan Johnson and had composed Knives Out. And it's such an enveloping, transporting score, and it just completely gives you this evocative mood that Guillermo creates with the film. And I thought it was one of the best attributes of the film, and especially impressive given how under the wire it was.
Yeah, that's a good point. Sometimes, you know, we theorize that these films are being held to be that last minute surprise of the season, but this one was legitimately being held to be finished. So it is an exciting latecomer. So David, you would put it in the 10 for picture, right? Which I think it's getting way more crowded than I thought that would be at the beginning of the season.
I feel like we keep saying this, but yeah, I do. I mean, I think that the Best Picture lineup looks quite different from how it did a couple weeks ago before we'd seen a lot of these movies. I do think a lot of them will end up factoring in. I would be surprised if Nightmare Alley is not one of those 10.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, it's just getting more and more competitive, so we'll have to see how it all shakes out.
So now let's go to our colleague, Chris Murphy, who got on Zoom with Halle Berry, who is making her directorial debut and acts in the film Bruised. And also, it's right about 20 years since she won her Oscar for Monsters Ball. And I think there's some really interesting reflection from her about that win in this interview, too. So let's listen to it.
Congratulations on the film. It's so fantastic and it's so exciting. You've been in the industry for decades.
Ever.
And you're yeah, I guess forever. And you're finally making your directorial debut with Bruce. What was it like to get behind the camera for the first time?
Oh my gosh, it was exciting, exhilarating, scary, rewarding, all of those things. It was all of those things rolled into one.
How long have you known that you wanted to direct? I mean, you've been starring in films, you know, for a long time, as you've said. When did you sort of get the directing bug?
I think I got the idea that it was something I could do probably 10 years ago. I thought, I think this might be the second act of my career. It might be in my future. But I intended on directing a short first. I had written a short about plastic surgery, and I was going to do this little short film, and I thought that would be my entry into my directing career.
Okay, wow, that's a very big leap from plastic surgery to mixed martial arts. What happened with that short, and then how did you land on Bruised?
Well, the short just never got done. I kept getting pushed and pushed and pushed, and I just kept working as an actor, and I just never, you know, I'd written it and I was all set to go, but I never really dedicated the time to do it. But I always was intending to, right? It's one of those things that was always gnawing at me. And when this came along, this was just given to me as a script to be an actor in the movie, never to direct it. I never even thought I would direct this movie. I thought I just wanted to play the MMA fighter. That was largely enough for me. It was a big, huge role. I'd have to spend a couple years training and getting my body into shape and learning all these, you know, different disciplines, martial art disciplines. And that was largely enough. So I didn't even really expect to be on this journey directing this film, honestly.
Wow. So then how did you go from just starring to directing? Yeah.
Well, because once I, you know, when I got the script, it was written for a very young 20-something white Irish Catholic girl. So I obviously couldn't play that. So I, Blake Lively had the script at the time. And my agent says, if Blake does it, then obviously you can't. But if she passes on her own volition, if she passes, I'll make sure you get a shot at it. And I knew, well, that will require me reimagining the role for a middle-aged black woman in a whole different world, because the world that's on paper is not the world I can exist in. So while I was waiting for her to decide, it took her about 6 months to decide. While she was doing that, I was actively and passionately reimagining the character for a black woman like me and in a world that I understood. So when she passed, I had the opportunity to go to Basil Iwanek, he was a producer at the time, and pitch my version of it. And to my surprise, he said, yes, that sounds like yes. I said, yes. Now, he said, now, Halle, go find a filmmaker. I said, will do. I'm going to go find a filmmaker. I'll be back.
And guess what?
Couldn't find. It's not that I couldn't find one. They were wonderful filmmakers, but the problem was is the reimagining was only in my head at that point. It wasn't put to paper yet. Like, you only get to reimagine someone's script when you become the director. And as a filmmaker, you often sit with the writer and you reimagine a story if you've been given the job of directing it. And I hadn't been given that job yet. So all I had in my mind when I sat down with these filmmakers was my pitch, my story, how I saw it. And I realized that none of them really saw it like I saw it in my head. Either they loved the drama part of it and thought, but does it have to be a fight movie? I don't really like the fight game, you know? And they were all women. I needed a female director. That was a caveat. Or they would say, I love the fight part, but do we need all that drama? Like, that's a lot of story. I think we just do a fight film. And I needed both. I needed the story and the fight. So I realized after trying for a while that I was the only one that really understood all the components of at least the story that I had in my head. And it occurred to me, a very good friend of mine said, I think you should do this because you speak about it with so much passion. You understand it like no one seems to understand it. You love it like nobody seems to love it. I think you should do it. And I was like, are you high? are you smoking something? Because there's no way. And she said, no, think about it. Think about it. Don't let fear get in the way. Think about it. And then a couple days went by and I thought, yeah, I'm not going to let fear get in the way. You're right. I'm going to do it. And then that's how it happened. I decided to do it.
Wow. That is really wild. Just, it's such a singular performance in film. It's hard to, the journey from Blake Lively to you, it's like, that's fantastic. And the film has clearly changed, you know, it had to have shifted and changed so much. Did you work with Michelle Rosenfarb on the screenplay to get it to what you needed it to be for you to star in it and act in it and direct it?
Yes. And luckily she's one of those gracious writers that was open to me reimagining her whole story. And so I worked for almost a year. She and I worked, we were attached at the hip and we worked very closely together. And in all fairness, this just wasn't a world that she knew anything about, but I knew everything about. We kept the bones of her script intact because she had beautiful bones, which is what I loved about it when I first read it. But the characters and the dialogue and the setting and all of that had to be changed to accommodate this world that I had in my head. Like, for example, Manny in her original script, he talked a lot. And so in my version, he was rendered mute, just like Jackie becomes when he gets dropped back into her life. They're oddly silenced, the two of them.
Wow. I mean, that's, speaking about Manny, I mean, he's such a wonderful child actor. And you have a son around the same age as Manny. Did you pull from your own, you know, experience as a mother, you know, when having these really intense scenes with this child actor?
Well, I wouldn't say that. My life with my children are very different than the life that's presented in this movie that Jackie has with her son. So I can't say I used that. But what I did use is my sensibilities as a mother. I'm a mother. I know what it means to be a mother. I know what it would mean to not be able to be a mother. I know the pain that would be associated with that, the guilt that would be associated with that. I also know that for a woman to leave a child, that's not naturally what we do. So there has to be a profound reason why a mother leaves a child. You know, I think that's very different from men and women. I'm not saying that men don't have reasons, but, you know, men historically have left families. Mothers historically don't. They don't leave their children, for better or for worse. Sometimes they should probably give them a better life, but we don't. It's just not what we do. So I connected to all of those feelings because I am a mother.
Going back to sort of the training process, right? I have to imagine this was sort of like a mammoth task. You have to train for this incredibly physically demanding role, and you also have to act in it, and you're also directing. How did you sort of train as an athlete or juggle training as an athlete, an actress, and a director?
That was probably my biggest challenge because the training for the to be the fighter took up a lot of hours in my day. I started training probably 2.5 years before I actually started filming. So that was a lot of pretty much everyday training except Sunday off. Probably 4 or 5, sometimes 6 hours a day. Learning, like, you know, MMA, you have to learn all the disciplines. So I was learning judo, aikido, taekwondo, muay thai, boxing, kickboxing, wrestling, like all of these different disciplines I had to learn aspects of in order to put this fight together. Mm-hmm. And then I would spend my time doing that. I was also doing John Wick at the time that I was preparing for this movie. So I'd be on the set in Morocco filming John Wick, and then I'd be up all night with Michelle talking about Bruised and going over scene after scene and rearranging. And then when I got to pre-production, I was still in my fight training every day, but then I would go to the production office and I would sit with my production designer, my DP, and go over shot lists. I would go on location scout, sit with my costume designer, like all the things that the director does. I would put all in one day, but it just made for a super long day. I would start at 5 in the yeah. morning and be done at midnight. And I just did that again and again and again because I was actually essentially doing two jobs.
That's a kind of a crazy schedule, especially with John Wick. And you got injured on the set of John Wick, right? And then also, I read that you also got injured at the very beginning of Bruised. Did that derail anything? Are you okay? It's such an intense physical movie. Are you okay right now? It's
I am okay.
Oh, thank God. Okay.
And you're right. I got injured in the training process of John Wick. I broke 3 ribs. Mm. And that movie is such that it could absorb a shutdown, right? It's a big movie. It's got a lot of money behind it. So we had to shut down. When I broke my ribs, I told everybody I'm hurt. They found out. We shut down. When it came to Bruised, I knew 2 days, we shot this fight scene first because Valentina and I, we were now ready. We'd gone through training camp together. We had done a weight cut, all that. We were ready. So we shot the fight scene first. And 2 days into a 4 or 5 day fight sequence, I broke 2 ribs. But I knew that if I told anybody, they would shut me down. I would lose my financing, which was teetering most days anyway. And I knew that I would lose Valentina. You know, she's the current flyweight champion. The fact that she took 2.5, 3 months out of her schedule to come play with me in a movie when she is the reigning champion, I knew I couldn't ask that of her twice. So I knew I would lose her. And to me, there was no better opponent for me in the film than Valentina. So, and because I had been training for almost 2-3 years, I had developed the fighter's mentality. So quitting just wasn't an option. It was like, okay, I'm hurt. I can't tell anybody. We'll be shut down. My dream will die very hard. We just have to keep going. So I just didn't tell anybody until the fight was over that I was even injured. And then I went to the hospital, got x-rays. Sure enough, I was injured. But at this point, my biggest physical challenge was behind me. So then I could rearrange my schedule and put any other fighting that I had to do towards the end of my shoot to sort of give me my ribs a little bit of time to heal. So that's what I did.
That is absolutely wild. I didn't realize that that was a real, you were going toe to toe with a real honest to God champion MMA.
Champ, she's a beast. She is a beast. So to say that I got broken ribs, I mean, I think most people would get some broken ribs.
I want to talk, I mean, you've throughout your career, you've never shied away from intense traumatic work or, you know, movies that really go somewhere and that really sort of challenge the audience and that I think challenge you as an actress. What was the most difficult scene for you to direct yourself in? Was it the, like, you know, the boxing stuff, or was it the intense emotional, you know, there's some really intense things that happened to Jackie in the movie?
Well, the fight was really hard because it's just hard to shoot a fight scene in general, you know, so that was hard. And I had felt a lot of pressure to get that scene right, you know, to really represent MMA and all of those disciplines in a way where real fighters would look at it and say, okay, well, yeah, I kind of believe that. Like, that was important to me. But I think the emotional scenes, like probably the scenes that I had with my mother, with Angel, you know, that there's a scene where I confront her about some abuse that happened to my character as a child. I think those kinds of scenes are always hard for anybody. You know, I think that was hard for the actress Adrienne Lennox. It was hard for me. And we knew that we needed to bring truth and honesty to these moments, but it's hard to say some of these things. You know, it's hard to, you know, be free enough in these moments to let the truth come out, you know, and not worry about how you'll be perceived or what people will think about it, you know. And what I loved about all the actors is that I needed to have actors that wouldn't be afraid of the truth and who would just service these characters and not judge them, you know, but actually find ways to love them and bring their characters to the screen. So it was hard in those kind of moments to sit in the darkness and do it anyway.
You know, having seen you, you know, from BAPS to X-Men to these really specifically made up characters in specific ways, to see you, you spend most of the movie with blood literally all over your face, bruises everywhere. Was that exciting? Was that challenging? Were you worried at all about just like the physical appearance on screen in the camera at all? Or was that just like, that's who that woman is?
It was so liberating and so freeing to just wake up, and however I woke up, how jacked up it was, great. I'm going to use this today in every way. It was just freeing, especially having so many responsibilities. That's one thing I didn't have to care about. You know, I didn't have to care about, you know, and I loved putting on those bruises every day. I loved stepping into this character of this woman. She was so real and so human. It was a great relief for me. That's all I can say. It was just a huge relief to be, to get outside my physical self and to, as a character, show that we are more than our physical self that we walk around in. And to tap into that part of who this woman was just one of my greatest gifts, which is one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story.
Yeah. And something else that I loved personally, you know, as a hip hop fan and as a female MC hip hop fan, is the soundtrack, which honestly becomes like another character in the film. You know, we got Saweetie, we've got Cardi B, we've got Flo Milli, we've got all these amazing, you know, female MCs. When did you know that it was like, oh, we got to have all just like the best, you know, girls in the game on this film, and only girls?
Yeah. Well, I knew in the onset. When I was given the job as a director, being a Black woman, I knew that this was an opportunity for me to tell a story and have it have a very female feeling to it, have it have a female gaze. And I knew one of the first and most important ways I can do that is have it have a sound that only generated from women. That would be a subconscious way of infusing femininity into this story and our point of view. So I knew early on that I wanted it to be hip hop, because I know that that's the music and the lingo of the inner city where I was setting this story. And I knew that I wanted it to be all women. Now, did I know it would come together with the likes of Cardi B and Saweetie and her and, you know, Young M.A.? No, but I knew that it was going to be all female hip hop voices. So when these caliber of women saw the movie and I asked them to be a part of it and they said yes, then I was like, holy shit, this is really going to be good. Like, this is going to be not only a backdrop of the movie, but it's going to be, I realized it was history. There had never been an all female hip hop record before. I didn't know that at the onset. So when I realized that, I was looking for just the, you know, the fabric of the film to hold the story together. But then I realized this was bigger than just the fabric of my film. This has something that's never been done before. I just didn't realize that.
It was great. It was so great. And I got to say, so we've talked a little bit before this conversation about how you sort of had to fight, you know, even after winning your Oscar for Monsters Ball, you had to fight your way through, you know, through your career to make movies, to star in movies, and even to get this movie made, which is such a parallel to Jackie's story of being a fighter and fighting her way through life. Did you find any parallels between your, you know, your career and your life story with Jackie's? And did you use them? Did you push them aside to focus on Jackie?
Oh my God, always use them. As an actor, I use everything that's available to me to bring whatever character to life. And yeah, the parallels I use, I've been fighting my whole life within this industry as a Black woman, fighting to make a way out of no way. When I started 30 years ago, there were not nearly the opportunities that Black women get to enjoy and experience today. I was literally struggling to find work. And even after my Oscar win, which is one of the greatest achievements of my life, I still struggled, you know, like the script truck didn't just back up to my front door with all these amazing roles for me to play. You know, there was still nothing. And I still had to figure out how to make a way for myself. And especially in the way that I was dreaming, because I wanted to play roles that were diverse and different. And I wanted to break new ground. I didn't want to keep playing the roles I had been playing, always wanting to challenge myself like other artists get to do. Like, that's what I wanted to do, not be pigeonholed. And those kinds of roles just didn't really exist for me. So I had to either make them, take big chances, do things that I thought were maybe subpar, but I have to do it. I have to try. You know, I have to try to. And it's also how I earned a living. I was raising two children, too. It wasn't a hobby. Acting is also what I love, but it's how I earn a living, you know. So it's complicated. It's very complicated.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that you say, you know, you have to do some things that are subpar, because I feel like the younger generation, or sort of even my generation, is really, you know, gravitating and really appreciates and is like reevaluated and fully embraced some of, you know, some films that maybe didn't get the love that they deserved, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. We got Saweetie dressing up as Catwoman for Halloween, you know, we've got, it just seems like we're getting, you know, you're getting sort of your flowers in real time, even though you've gotten them through your career. Do you feel that too, or how does that feel to you?
I do feel that, and it feels good. You know, never doing things to get flowers. I've never been that person to, you know, you don't know what's going to bring you flowers or awards. But when someone reaches back and gives you a flower or awards you for something or says, we appreciate you, we see you, good job, that's always a good feeling. But if that doesn't happen, it doesn't mean it stops my train, you know. It doesn't mean I don't stop working hard and striving to achieve and take risks or chances.
Absolutely. And Cardi B, she's giving you the People's Icon Award, the People's Choice Award. That's a great, that fits perfectly with the film. How does that feel?
That's amazing, because she's an icon in her right, you know, and all these girls are, I mean, I know there was some like Nicki Minaj, you know, scuffle buffle, but the truth is all of them are queens to me. I love them all. You know what I mean? If there's one thing I hate that these girls, or that we get pit against each other. Like, we're all in this struggle together. No shade towards Nicki, no shade towards any of these girls. But to me, Cardi is a queen. Nicki's a queen. Sweetie's a queen. Her's a queen. Like, they're all queens to me. So I meant no disrespect, and I hate that was the spin on it, because that's just not true. All these ladies are amazing what they're doing, and these young rappers and trappers and hip-hoppers, they're doing what men have been doing in that industry, and they're doing it now for themselves. And I'm wildly proud of all of them, and I cheer. I want all of them to win and keep winning.
Absolutely. You're one of the only celebrities that really is nailing social media and nailing Twitter all the time. Like, it's so, like, your presence, it's so great. It's so fun. It's so fantastic. Do you feel social media has sort of shaped, or the advent of social media has sort of, you know, changed your career or shaped your relationship with your fans and, you know, the people who are getting to know you in this different way now?
It has totally reshaped my relationship with the public and with my fans. I have gotten to be my authentic self. You know, one of the things I used to hate about, which is why I love podcasts, what we're doing right now, what I used to hate about the public relations part of what we did as actors, you would sit down for an interview with a magazine and you would talk about whatever you talk about. Many times you spend an hour, 2 hours talking, and they would editorialize, they would cherry pick what they put in the article, and they got to shape it their way. And it didn't always mean that it was a true representation of who I was or really what I had to say. And it was out of my control, and it got so bad. Like, for 8 years, I stopped talking. I stopped doing interviews just for that reason. I was tired of the way I was being written about, and these edit and the story that was being told and spun. So social media has given me a chance to say things in my own voice in real time, talk about what I want to talk about and not talk about what I don't want to talk about. And it's not that I don't have an opinion about a lot of stuff in the world, but some stuff I don't want to talk about in the world. I want to keep my opinion to myself and my friends, or, you know, my feelings. Everything I think isn't for public consumption, you know, but social media allows me to show parts of myself that I do want to share. And I love that part about social media. And I especially love Twitter. I've had fun. Late to the game on Twitter, but I love that I'm there now.
Hey, you're late to the party, but you're the most fun person at the party there, I gotta say. And I gotta say too, it's so interesting that you said you sort of like didn't speak for 8 years, because that's such a parallel to Manny in the movie and Bruce, you know, in terms of silencing yourself. So I just think that's such a beautiful, you know, bridge, you know, between, you know, Jackie's silence and Manny's silence, and how you were like, you know what, you know, protecting yourself in that way. It is a protection mechanism too, to like not let, you know.
It is. And sometimes you do it because you're just stunned. You're shocked and you don't know what to do. And I believe if you don't know what to do, do nothing until you know what to do.
I gotta say, wow. I think that's all the time we have. But Hallie, I have to say, this has been so fantastic and illuminating. I mean, from, you know, Blake Lively to Cardi B, we got it all. You know?
We
got it all here. So I really thank you for coming on the pod. And it was absolutely fantastic talking to you.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me. I wish you continued success.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
And now finally, we'll hear my conversation with Gabby Hoffman, who is in Come On, Come On, a movie that I love and Richard loves. And she plays a mother and a really complicated mother in a season of complicated mothers. And I had a really good time talking to her about motherhood. She has children herself and kind of how she brings that into her work and tries to balance it with her work. It's a topic that I think a lot of professional women shy away from, but she got into it in a really refreshing way. And I was really happy to talk to her. So let's hear that.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the moms in your life as a mom watching this movie who's kind of obsessed with it? I imagine you are hearing from many people who feel very seen.
Yeah, well, none of the moms in my life have seen it yet, but
Well,
it hasn't come out yet. It comes out tomorrow. But certainly, you know, just walking the streets of Telluride and the various rooms I've been in where people have seen a screening, yes, the mothers have an especially kind of emotional response. But I'll say it's kind of across the board. One of the best moments was when we walked out of the first screening in Telluride, and a probably 65-year-old, huge, like 6'5" man who, you know, looked like he belonged at a football game, collapsed into my arms sobbing. Wow. He was crying so hard he could not form a sentence. And we just held each other for a while. And then we walked around the corner, Mike and I were talking, and two like 16-year-old girls came up, also with tears in their eyes. So, you know, it's really getting everyone.
So when you talked to my coworker, Dave, at Telluride, you talked about reading the script being an out-of-body experience when you were talking to Mike. And I was curious just what that meant exactly.
God, good question. I have no idea I said that. I think what I was probably talking about was, so I had had this long, lovely dinner with Mike where we talked about everything, a little bit about the movie, but just about life and parenting and art and filmmaking and each other. And so I knew I wanted to keep having that conversation with him and collaborate with him on this. And then I read the screenplay. And I think what I meant by out of body was that it felt in these sort of like emotional brush strokes sort of way, like something, like a dream-like version of something that I had been thinking about writing, right? So I'm a parent and it is what I do with 99% of my time every day, all year long. And it's the most interesting, rewarding, frustrating, wonderful thing I can ever imagine doing. And so it is what I think about all the time. And I've tried to write a little bit about it. And then this beautiful screenplay lands on my lap that has so many of those colors and notes and ideas and feelings and questions and themes, and that it was bizarre almost, because I don't really ever get screenplays that are about the things in life that I'm thinking about. So yeah, it was like some incredibly well done cousin of something that, you know, maybe existed somewhere deep in the recesses of my heart.
I feel like so much of writing about parenting, there's this trap of sentimentality that you fall into really easily. And like anyone talking about their own kids, you hear yourself and you're like, oh my God, that's not what I mean, but I can't get the right words for it. Is that what you found trying to write about something like this? That like there are so many pitfalls in getting it right, and then this comes to you?
Yeah, when I say try to write about it, like it's not like I was trying to write a screenplay or anything. It's more just, you know, my own little notes about my kids, right? And wanting to get down some of these moments in a day that are so pregnant with feeling that are, yeah, really hard to articulate because of all the reasons you just said. And you put them all together the way that Mike did, and you have this cohesive, beautiful expression of the entirety of this experience.
Yeah. Is writing a screenplay or something just more formal, like something you've been pursuing, or is it like in the back of your mind somewhere?
Definitely nothing I'm pursuing presently. I'm very, very happy these days to just show up on set and do this one job and go home and not have to feel responsible for anything else outside of my own household. But I used to, you know, I'm just always interested in recording through writing what's happening in life. I'm very bad at doing it because I can't ever find the time. But one day I imagine I may be have the mind and heart space to sit down and try to write something, but I can't imagine when that will be.
I mean, it's interesting looking at just like your IMDb credits, because you were on Transparent and Girls pretty consistently for a while. And those are, you know, people talk about being on a TV show. It's steady. You go to the same place. You see the same people. And then those end. And like, this is really the first feature you've made since then. So I'm curious about what kind of surfacing from that was like, and then how it affected the choices that you've made. You know, something like Come On, Come On feels like a no-brainer. But what's that transition been like for you?
Yeah, I actually hadn't realized that it had been so long since I'd made a film rather than television until somebody brought it up in an interview. For me, I mean, Girls, I think about very differently than Transparent, because I was really not there very much. Yeah. You know, it was like a whole bunch at once and then a smattering here and there. And it was always just so much fun and such a joy to go and dip into that world of lovely people and play such a fun, wonderful character. Transparent was really like, you know, part of the seasons of my life for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I started Transparent at the same time that I became pregnant with my first child. So really, the reason I haven't made a film in so many years is because I was working 3 months a year on Transparent. It was enough work to feel creatively fulfilled and to pay the bills. And otherwise, I wanted to be with my kids.
Yeah.
And unless something is good enough to take to that I have to do it, I'm not leaving home for any other reason. And this is the first thing that was good enough that I had to do it, you know, mm-hmm. that I not just had to, but desperately wanted to.
Yeah. I mean, is that an attitude you feel like is going to continue even as your kids get older? Like, I think when, you know, kids are younger, it takes a lot more hands on, and then, you know, you hit kindergarten and it's easier to do stuff. Or do you always want to have that, like, no, I'm going to stay really choosy until something really, really, really pulls me out?
You know, I try really hard not to project into the future too much, because it seems like a big waste of time, because we're, you know, forever and ever again and again surprised by our lack of foresight, my own, you know, despite my planning. But yeah, I don't know that a 13-year-old needs any less than a 3-year-old. I mean, sure, the daily practicalities of, like, hopefully I'm not wiping their butt at that age. But
you never know.
Emotionally and psychologically, I think they may need even more as they get older. So I am both very, very excited to be in this phase of my life where I really am interested in acting. And that's only been true for the past few years, you know, and it's growing. And that's exciting, because I really, you know, I'm still kind of open to, like, oh, who knows what I'll be doing professionally in 3 or 4 years or in 10 years or 15 years. I'm open to it being something else. But I'm also really thrilled by my deepening interest in doing this. And also my access to good work, you know, which I hope is growing. So I'm looking forward to that. And I do feel like it is an unbelievable privilege to do this with one's life, right? Like I was just talking about this in the other room. Most people go to work and they have to suppress their humanity just in order to keep their job, right? Whether you're serving burgers at a diner, or you're a CEO, or, you know, or you're a lawyer protecting big oil rights, you know, like you are really having a very limited experience of the incredibly deep dynamic experience that is being a human being. And my job is to dive deep and deeper into our humanity and explore that. And wow, that's just such an incredible gift. And I enjoy it so much. So that pull is really there for me. And I also feel like I'm just beginning to understand what I'm capable of as an actor. Like, it really feels like I just started doing this to me on some level. At the same time, nothing compares in importance or in the experiential joy and depth of being a parent, you know, and being there with my kids. So this is like, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on about this is the thing. This is the thing I think about a lot. And I want so desperately to have these conversations with other people, especially mothers, but certainly any parent in the business, because it's a really tricky one, you know. And I see these like round tables of actresses talking about making movies and stuff, and I'm like, but wait a minute, how were you in Berlin for 4 months when you have a 13-year-old? Like, what are the logistics of that? Like, weren't they pissed off to be taken out of school, or did you leave them? Like, how often did you fly back? Like, I want to know how people pull this off in a way that feels good to them. Like, I want to raise my own kids. We don't have a nanny. We never have. You know, I want to be there. And I also want to be having this other experience. So it's a really tricky one, as lucky as it is. I feel like the luckiest person in the world. I don't think there's any great time to not be home with your kids, you know, for their well-being.
Well, this is something that a writer who I worked with pointed out to me about Come On, Come On specifically, that you've got Viv in this like really nightmare situation with her, I guess, ex-husband. But there's a freedom in it in not being in the day-to-day involvement of her son's life. Like, there's this sense of like putting out a different fire, of kind of getting away from it. And that resonates really hard with me whenever I travel for work and it's like, well, this is hard and I miss them, but like I get to breathe and I get to do something different. Did that hit you on any level too, of just that break from it also being an important part of motherhood?
Yes, I get a lot out of working, and I get a lot out of being in a creative, collaborative space with the likes of people like Mike Mills, you know, and Joaquin and Woody, and you know, I love being around people who are interested in what we're doing here, right? I am kind of like forever turned on by the questioning that making movies ultimately is, right? And the investigative nature of trying to find something that is real and honest with other people. That is thrilling. And that is very different, doing it in that way on a set, making something, then doing it in other ways of one's life. So yes, I get the most out of it. I also just can't bear to miss too much of the other stuff, you know? So.
Well, I think you see that in the movie
too. And you know,
too.
The thing about Viv is like, that question is, you know, this comes up a lot, like, oh, she's not there. Somebody said, you know, the whole time I'm thinking, is she a good mother? Because it kind of seems like she might not be a great mom. She's not with her kid. Yikes. And I thought, wow, you must not have kids, because so much of what parenting is, I mean, a lot of what I experience is like, there are these contradicting needs, right? Even first, just for your own kid, right? Like in this example of Viv, she needs to go take care of her son's father, right? She's not doing that because she doesn't want to be with her kid. She is doing that to make sure that her kid has a dad who can be a part of his life.
Yeah.
So that is essential. But it's also true in like the smallest ways, right? Like my daughter wants me to sit down and watch what she's drawing, and she needs me to be present in that way, in that moment. And I want to be, but if I don't finish making her dinner, she's going to be starving and have a meltdown in 20 minutes. And then she's not going to get to bed on time, and she's going to be a fucking wreck the next day. So we're constantly, as parents, you know, it's such a cliche, I fucking hate this word, but juggling, you know, desperately trying to create this sort of balanced, harmonious environment for our kid first and foremost, but then that really means for the whole family, right? And then the mother, if you think of her as the kind of, you know, the sun to the solar system of the family, I think Mike said that the other day. I'm totally stealing it. Then where is her well-being in all of that, right? And that might mean being gone for 6 months a year working, or in my case, less. But that feeds and nourishes her soul and heart and mind so that she can then come and offer to her kids and her entire family life what her best self. So it's the trickiest thing in the world, and it's so interesting, and we all do it in different ways, and I don't think there's a right way to do it at all. There's just the way that feels most comfortable to each of us. And so I'm sort of navigating all of that as I now have, yes, a slightly older kid and another one who's younger, and I don't know what it will look like in 5 years, but I certainly know that it's going to be completely surprising and unpredictable. And at times, you know, yeah, you're doing the very difficult work of caretaking in ways that you could never have imagined and didn't plan for, just like we see Viv doing in this movie.
Yeah. Mike talked to another one of my colleagues about, we did a story about, you know, the amount of movies this year with children in them, kind of children in the lead. And he said about, like, when there's a little person in pajamas on a set, it changes the entire, like, temperature of the room. Like, it makes everyone act differently. Is that something that you see yourself as an adult, or that you remember from when you were a kid on set?
You know, Woody and Mike and I have been doing interviews all morning, and, you know, every 5 minutes we were sort of riffing on this idea that Woody was by far the most professional actor on set, and that Joaquin and I were just a couple of obnoxious buffoons. So I know what Mike means, but I actually, yes. I mean, of course, there is a tenderness that comes with a small person being present, but Woody was just... he's such an actor through and through, and he is such an intelligent and present and thoughtful and lovely person that it really did not feel the way that so many times I've been on sets with quote unquote child actors. We're all sort of rejecting that term today, but you know, where they really need a different kind of energy around them. Woody was, he's just like very much an actor who's interested in the work and doing it. Also a wonderfully funny, playful kid, which we all sort of were on that set. So, yeah.
His performance reminds me of when you were a child on screen. And I wonder if you see that yourself or if it's too close to see.
That's incredibly generous of you. No, I don't see that myself. I mean, I don't watch myself as a child on screen, but in the few times, I think many years ago, my husband and I watched Field of Dreams, which I hadn't seen since it came out, you know, and I was like, what is that movie that everybody's so obsessed with? And then it started and we were like, wait a minute, this movie is about Back to the Lander hippies who are having like strange stoned fantasies?
Book-burning debates at a school board? It's kind of crazy.
Oh my God, so good. Oh, Amy Madigan in that school board scene is so brilliant.
Righteous Fury.
She is so good. I wish she was still out there working a lot. I do not think that I was nearly as talented as Woody. I did not care about acting. I was not through and through an actor at that age like Woody is. I think I had some basic natural talent, I guess, enough that I kept showing up on these sets, but I did not think about it. I did not care about it. I loved being on movie sets because they were fun, because I liked being around adults. But no, I read nothing but falseness in my early performances, to be honest.
So harsh.
I think Woody is so just genuinely, he's very honest in his performance. He's very, so thank you, but no, I don't agree.
You say you don't like thinking that far in the future. So is there anything that you think of generally when you look ahead at all? Like any slight shape of the future when you think of it?
Well, I chose to have kids, right? So I have to be hopeful about the future. Mm-hmm. There's no other route for me. Otherwise, I'll go insane. So I see this period of time. I sort of will myself to see this period of time that we're in as the incredibly uncomfortable, painful, destructive phase of this iteration of this world and this population as moving toward something that works a lot better for everyone. So I try to imagine my kids, maybe I'll still be around, but my kids living in a sort of new world that is one that values all the right things instead of seemingly all the wrong things. And at times it's hard to see that given what's happening. But I know it's possible, and I choose to believe that that is where we're headed.
I like to imagine my kids being part of whatever makes the better new world, too. Like, maybe it's flattering myself, but why work so hard to raise them right if they're not going to get us somewhere better, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think anyone who is walking this earth with a sense of love and kindness and compassion and respect for one another is doing something to make it a better place. You know, whether or not they're innovating the solution for clean water, as long as they're looking at their fellow human beings with dignity and respect and love, that's what we need.
That does it for this week's show. You can find us at VanityFair.com writing about West Side Story and Nightmare Alley and Richard's Top 10 List and the Gotham Awards. And it's a busy week. There's a lot to read. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I am at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David and Rebecca, you know where to find them. You can also sign up to text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 213-513-7035. I think after this week, we'll have a lot of questions about awards, so we'll be happy to answer them. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best mantra to carry you through award season goes to Richard Lawson.
This is all made up.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
From PRX.